Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Scott Galloway to the broadcast. Scott is a professor of marketing at New York University's Stern School of Business. He's also the author of The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Scott's also the founder of 9 firms, including L2, Red Envelope, and Profit. Scott served on the board of directors of Eddie Bauer, the New York Times Company, Gateway Computer, and Berkeley's Haas School of Business. He was elected to the World Economic Forum's Global Leaders of Tomorrow and was named one of the world's 50 best business school professors by Poets and Quants in 2012. Scott received a bachelor's degree from the University of California, Los Angeles, and an MBA from the University of California at Berkeley. I recently caught up with Scott in his office in New York City, and we discussed several themes from his book, The Four, including how these companies fulfill our needs for God, love, consumption, and sex, society's reverence for founder CEOs, how we are willing to ignore the negligent and destructive behaviors of these companies. We also discuss the potential benefits of the companies competing against each other, how Amazon is shooting out ahead of the others, and a variety of other topics. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by TopTal, an exclusive network of the top freelance software developers, designers, and finance experts in the world. I recently caught up with TopTal CEO Tasso Duval, and he offered the following top 5 trends for hiring top talent.
The top 5 trends for hiring top talent are: 1, hiring talent remotely, ensuring that they are able to work remotely and that companies are hiring talent remotely. 2, leveraging teams in different dispersed locations. If you're hiring in-house and you're leveraging remotely a bit, being open to having talent even in the same time zone is an important factor that we've noticed. 3, highly skilled teams becoming the majority rather than the lead, meaning ensuring that the team composition comprises of predominantly high-skilled labor rather than high-skilled labor supported by lower-skilled labor. 4, infrastructure being created to support those teams, ensuring that the teams in-house are connected with the remote teams that are working together. And 5, flexibility with offer packages. We've seen that even the in-house talent that are joining companies from Google to Facebook and on are interested in demanding that there is a remote component to their job, whether it's one day a week or full-time, be included within their offer packages.
Scott Galloway, welcome. It's great to speak with you today.
Thanks for having me.
No, my pleasure. First of all, congratulations on your terrific book, The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. I wanted to take a moment to dive into some of the key messages from the book. And one of the most interesting ones forms sort of a thesis behind the power of each of these four organizations is that you use a lot of body analogies. Google is the brain or the replacement for God. Facebook is the heart, the source of love. Amazon is the tie to consumption, the gut, if you will. And Apple is the tie to sex or the genitals, I suppose, of the human body. And I wonder if you could take a moment just to briefly kind of dive into the details as to the rationale behind the connections between each of those.
Our brain is robust enough to ask very complex questions, but not strong enough to answer them. So we've always had super beings that attempt to fill that void. And as we become more affluent and educated, societies tend to become less reliant on a super being, and church attendance actually declines, but we still have these modern day anxieties. And anyone who has kids is prey. You send up a query hoping there'll be some divine intervention by an all-knowing being who can send you back an answer. And now it's symptoms treatment of croup into the Google dialog box. If you look at the queries you present to our modern man God, Google, you'll quickly realize you trust Google more than any priest, rabbi, scholar, professor, mentor, boss. Google knows the diseases you have, the diseases you're worried about exposing yourself to, whether you're thinking of getting married or divorced, stewing your business partners, and what fetishes you have. So it is our modern man God. We trust it more than anything. There's some sort of divine intervention when our queries go up into the heavens. We don't understand what it does, but we know it sees everything and will send us back a divine or the purest answer we can hope for. Facebook taps into our need to be loved and to love others. It gives us the ability to love at scale, and the amount of people you have empathy for, specifically you care for, is an instinctive survival mechanism. The number one indicator of whether you're going to live to be 100 is how many people in your life do you love. So I think it's allowing us to do that at scale, mostly through images and pictures that create a lot of empathy. And then going into the gut, the company that's generally worth the most in the world is usually the company that masters the art of more for less, whether it's Dell or Walmart or China's strategy is more for less. And soon it's going to be Amazon. Right now it gives consumers the best deal in the world. It gives them all 100 cents on the dollar back in terms of the product and the service. And then finally, Apple is the most elegant way of communicating to people that you're part of the innovation class, that you have disposable income, that you live in a city, that you appreciate artisanship, that you maybe have a creative bent to you, that in sum, you have great genes that would make for a great mate. It's no different than a Panerai watch or driving a Ferrari. It signals that you are an attractive mate. God, love, consumption, and sex. It's who we are. These companies have disarticulated who we are, reassembled them in the form of for-profit companies, and created the market, combined market capitalization equivalent to the GDP of India.
Yeah, you point out that there are only six countries that have GDPs higher than the collective market caps of these four companies. Why are the four American companies? It'd be pretty impressive if three of the four were, but all 100% of the four are in fact based and grown here in the U.S. Why is that?
Not only in the U.S., but typically within a bike ride of a world-class major engineering university in the Bay Area. There's definitely something in the water here. I don't know if it's tolerance for failure. You know, people say we embrace failure. That's not really true. Americans tolerate failure. A robust venture capital community, this immigrant rebel risk-taking gene that started with the people who came over here initially and then kept migrating west, this optimism that's uniquely American, where people are willing to start, devote their lives and get other people to give them money to start stupid companies that make no sense and are crazy, but end up occasionally being crazy genius. World-class university education, we probably, I don't want to say we have a lock, but if you took the top 100 universities in the world, I think arguably we have 70 or 80 of them. So, and then a tax policy, and then a society that romanticizes entrepreneurship. These are our rock stars. So it's all of these things and more, which people who have been much more thoughtful about the subject, but yes, you know, try and name a company coming out of Europe that could challenge these guys. Pretty difficult.
You talk about the sort of rock star founders of these organizations. Of course, three of the four have the founders still very much involved at the helm. One, of course, very notably, Apple no longer does.
So I've run venture-backed companies for the last 20 years, started companies that have gone public, other companies that have declared Chapter 11. And raised a lot of money from the venture capital community. And the pendulum rarely hesitates at the midpoint. It's either way to the left or way to the right. And in the 90s, when I was first starting companies, the conventional wisdom was that at a certain point, you had to move the founder to chairman or out because founders were crazy and didn't have the business maturity to take a company public or run it. And then Steve Jobs changed everything. When he came back to Apple, as irrational and crazy as he was, those became features, not bugs. And all of a sudden, founders became the new must-have secret sauce of companies. And now I believe companies probably keep founders around maybe even longer than they should. Now, I don't think Jack Dorsey should be running Twitter. I think it's ridiculous that Twitter's board has decided that Jack at 25 hours a week is better than the rest of the management team at 50. I don't see how they maintain anybody in senior management that's any good. And if you look at the number of people who have left that organization, it kind of bears out that they don't buy that either. There's now this reverence for the tech founder CEO, and I think it's perverted our society a little bit. We no longer worship at the altar of kindness or character. We worship at the altar of innovators. And that is these guys and gals, to a certain extent, mostly guys, they are our new heroes. They're seen as a kind of a different class of people that should be protected and revered. The founder CEO is the new object of worship, or what I call kind of gross idolatry.
And we forgive a lot of sins of those heroes as well.
Yeah, I think these companies get kind of the mother of all hall passes. The companies are here to create a middle class and create economic value for their employees and their shareholders. And they're going to use every weapon at their disposal to do that. But you have companies who sort of wrap themselves in a very progressive neon pink, rainbow, or blue blanket. But they are absolutely, during the day, their business behavior is more indicative of the spawn of Darth Vader and Ayn Rand. I mean, these are companies that engage in massive tax avoidance. use their access to cheap capital to just overwhelm the competition, are destroying jobs. And some people would say that's okay. That's part of the process to replace low-paying jobs with high-paying jobs. But the job destruction here is just extraordinary. When you look at, for example, Google and Facebook will add $22 billion to the top line this year. They needed 12,000 additional people to service that additional $22 billion in business, whereas traditional media and advertising industry needs 150,000. So just in the next 12 months, you could fill up 2.5 Yankee stadiums of creative directors, agency planners, copywriters, and say, courtesy of Facebook and Google, you're out of business, or you're done. And it strikes me as unusual or ironic that Sheryl Sandberg catalyzed this incredibly important dialogue around trying to balance work and life for women. But a lot of the audiences she's speaking to, she is putting out of work. And it strikes me as interesting that I would think more people would say, you know, the work-life balance isn't going to be as important to me when I no longer have work as part of that balance because my agency is shut down or because I'm out of a job. And when you look at retail and what's happening there at the hands of Amazon, when you look at what's happening across our economy where we have the GDP of India spread across 700,000 employees and then a company like Uber figures out a way to create a two-class system with only 12,000 employees who share in the $70 billion with their investors of market cap this company has, and then 2.1 million driver partners, which is Latin for people who don't participate in the equity or the healthcare benefits. You know, there's just some dangerous, uncomfortable things here. Amazon has paid $1.4 billion in corporate income tax in 2008. Walmart has paid $64 billion, despite the fact Amazon has added the market cap of Walmart to its value in the last 24 months.
And you point out that, I mean, so much of what you're describing would seem to suggest that the regulators would want to get involved, but you make the point that these are the, you know, hot guys, hot girls, as you put it, at school, and everyone wants to be close to them. And so you mentioned actually, though that may not be coming soon, they are now encroaching on each other's space, which actually you believe to be a good thing, that as they start to compete together, that actually may have some benefits potentially. So why is the increasing overlap of the combined Venn diagram a good thing?
Well, there's safety and hatred. I don't think there aren't that many companies that can take on these guys with the exception of each other. And by the way, about the time a guy like me says that is usually when they're about to go into structural decline. So I acknowledge that up front. But it's a good thing that Amazon is coming for Netflix. It's a good thing that Google and Apple all now fighting for control of voice. I think that's a good thing. It's good for consumers. It's good to have a healthy ecosystem. I think we actually need more competition. There's been a big discussion. The last year has been, are these guys good or bad? And the answer is yes. So like any other company or market, they're going to do everything they can to grow shareholder value. And they're going to use all the weapons at their disposal. And if a market fails and you have one company that controls 90% of a market that's now greater by dollar volume than the entire advertising business of any nation in the world, i.e. Google, then have the markets failed? And do we need to intervene? And that's an important conversation. Whereas, you know, we really haven't had that conversation in the last year. It's been, are they good or bad? And now we're starting to say, yes, there's good and bad. The next question is going to be, should we break them up? Imagine this. Imagine an ecosystem and all you have is four logos, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. And then you have an ecosystem that has Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, Amazon Web Services, Amazon, Apple, iTunes, Google, YouTube. Is that ecosystem healthier? Would you have more employees? Would you have lower rents placed on their consumers and customers because there'd be more competition? Would you have more hiring? Would you have more M&A? Would you have more VC-funded small companies who all now see 10 or 12 big acquirers instead of four big acquirers? I think that's the question we're going to begin asking is, if you're a full-throated capitalist, is it time, have the markets failed here, and is it time to intervene? Because when I bring up the notion of breaking a company up, I'm called a socialist. And there's this immediate gag reflex. And I think what we have forgotten is that a key component of capitalism is that there's some referees on the field that occasionally throw a flag on these guys. And I think these companies get kind of five tries at a first down, whereas every other company in business gets four. Mm-hmm.
You actually hypothesize that there is likely to be the one eventually as Amazon is increasingly taking on the other three successfully. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about sort of its path to doing so, as well as what is so special about Amazon that's allowed it to do so.
I don't know if you remember in the 70s when I was a kid, there was this TV program called, I think it was called The All-Stars or The Superstars, and they brought the best athlete from all these different sports to compete in sort of a decathlon like competition.
Right.
You just had the stars. You had everyone from Roger Staubach to Will Chamberlain, you know, the best athletes in the world. And every year this pole vaulter named Bob Seagram won. He was the best athlete in the world. Amazon is the best athlete of the best business in the world. Wherever they're bumping up against the other three, they're winning. In voice, where they bump up against Google and Apple, they have 70% share in the home. And computer hardware, the most innovative product of the last 2 years wasn't the Apple Watch, the Apple Pods. It was Amazon's Echo device. In product search, where they compete against Google, they used to have a 44% share of product search. Now they have 55%. In streaming video, 2 years ago, they were number 7 in terms of share of streaming video during prime time. Now they're number 3. In digital marketing, their Amazon Media Group is growing faster than Google and almost as fast as Facebook. Anywhere Amazon is competing against the other three, it's winning. I've never seen a company firing on all 12,000 cylinders like this one. And I've predicted it'll be the first $1 trillion market cap company, despite the fact it's only at 500. And Apple is now at 900. I just don't see anything getting in the way of Amazon right now, with the exception of a district attorney in a state, a red state, or Brussels.
You've gone so far as to say you do actually see that potentially coming. You talked about like a district attorney seeing that as the fastest path to becoming a governor and you know, opening action against them and potentially leading to the breakup of Amazon. Do you see that potentially you know, happening in the relatively near term?
Yeah, I think it's going to happen in the next 12 to 24 months. So they're going to try. I think it most likely happens in Europe, though. And what you could also see is, I think the folks at Amazon are so smart. If I was advising them, and I'm not, I would prophylactically spin AWS. In other words, I would break myself up before someone comes in with a more blunt instrument. Amazon, in my view, is on the precipice of going to zero-click ordering, where they just begin fulfilling and sending the items via artificial intelligence, your purchase history, a fulfillment network that's unmatched, a level of consumer trust that's unmatched, and then the ability to manicure it using voice. I believe they're just going to start sending you products before you even ask for them, because you'll opt in and say, sure, I'd like to become a Prime Squared household. They'll take the average household purchases from 1,300 to 7,000. Now that they're in grocery, they have just that fluidity and almost every major category covered. The average household prime purchases will quadruple, and I believe their stock will become anti-gravity. And I think we're going to freak out and break them up. I think when we see just how many millions of jobs are going to go away that fast, and when we head to what I call the Amazon singularity, where every consumer stock trades on its performance, trades on interest rates, but more than anything, trades on what Amazon is or isn't doing in that sector. And we're already starting to see it. The biggest moves in consumer stocks seem to be based on an announcement from Amazon, on or off the record, that they're thinking about going into the drugstore business. They're thinking about going into the insurance business. They're thinking about, you know, all of a sudden companies swoon, or Nike goes up because Nike decides to distribute on Amazon. So we're headed to this weird singularity. And a key component of markets is that no one person, entity, or firm controls them. We are entering into an Amazon singularity where Amazon can literally take the value of any stock down 10, 20, 30% just with press releases.
I'm interested if their current momentum in cloud computing, in voice, in search, digital marketing, streaming, logistics, Amazon I'm referring to, of course, continues, what does that foretell for the other three? Where do you see them in, say, 10 years' time as a result of Amazon continuing to gobble up key businesses that they had traditionally been leaders in?
Well, it's a big economy. I don't think it's a zero-sum game with the Ford. And other companies will cry. People say Amazon or Walmart, and I think the answer is yes. I think both companies are going to do well. Amazon will probably own the top third, the most affluent households in America, whereas Walmart will serve everybody else. You know, search is an unbelievable business. Social, Amazon really hasn't figured out and doesn't, you know, they bought Twitch, but it doesn't look like they have a social network that can rival Facebook. And then, you know, Apple's vulnerable. I mean, Amazon is shooting out ahead. I don't think that means the other three are going to suffer. I think the other three are more vulnerable, have less robust businesses. I mean, we're talking about Michael Jordan and John Elway, but with Amazon, we have an athlete we've never encountered before. If Michael Jordan had gone to play baseball and that season had been MVP in the World Series, that's what we're talking about with Amazon. You know, we've never seen, they've totally blown out a pillar of business education, and that's core competence. Find a sector or a skill that you're really good at and sort of own it and focus on it. What if Starbucks had said 2 years ago, we're going to spend $4.5 billion on original scripted TV content? People would have said, you're crazy, we're cutting your sock in half. What if Nike started announcing patents for warehouses in the sky? They would have said, okay, Nike, you're amazing, but that's stupid. Amazon's doing all this stuff. We've never had a company that can go into any sector and overnight be a formidable player like Amazon. And sure, they fail, but then they kill it. They wait, they watch, and they usually come back at it and figure it out.
You talk about how each of the four, as they've grown in power, have also grown in negligence. You've said Google and Facebook have committed an involuntary manslaughter on the truth on an unprecedented scale. You've highlighted how Apple doesn't allow the FBI to search a phone of a known terrorist, despite the fact that if they were able to do so, they might be able to prevent future terrorist acts or at a minimum gain invaluable intelligence in the process. You know, so much of your book actually highlights, of course, the good things that each of these companies have done that have propelled them forward, but also the negligence, the fact that power continues to corrupt. Has it impacted the way in which you interact with the four?
No, I use them more than ever. I think consumers should buy the product that is best for their life. These are unbelievable companies with unbelievable consumer value propositions. So I don't tell people to stop buying iPhones. And I think they're generally good people doing what they're supposed to be doing. I think the failure here is of markets and of us, the citizenry, that won't elect leaders that enforce kind of what I call market checks or hold these firms accountable or to the same set of standards is the rest of business. And also, we're about to have a conversation around some difficult topics because these guys have sort of outpaced the general construct or norms of tax policy, of regulation. And we're just not used to a company that grows to $500 billion in value with no profits. How do we pay our soldiers, our firefighters, our social workers if the model for value creation is to not be profitable, meaning there's no tax base from corporations? Now, some people would say, well, everybody can do that, but they really can't. Once companies go profitable, they can't. It's very difficult for them to cut their profit outlook. We just haven't seen this before. And can we have a tax base where the smartest, most sophisticated companies, you know, do what they're supposed to do, and that is minimize their tax burden, which means licensing their IP to an Irish entity or an entity in the Isle of Man, and then that entity charges billions of dollars in licensing fees to their high tax domains, such as the US or Europe, suppressing the taxable income in high tax domains and inflating it in low tax domains, thereby massively decreasing their tax liability, which at the end of the day is a transfer of wealth and power from smaller and medium-sized companies to large multinationals. And it was our tax code, did we anticipate that a dry cleaner, a restaurant, a medium-sized manufacturing company would be subsidizing a large multinational? We've never had companies be weaponized. I am fairly confident the CEO of Forbes would say, I will commit that we will never be weaponized by the intelligence units of the Russian government. These companies are refusing to make that commitment. And for some reason, the public seems somewhat cool with that. We're getting increasingly angry, but we say, oh, they're different. There's so much content. It's really ridiculous. These companies, if the New York Times can keep us safe from Russian intelligence on $100 million in free cash flow, then shouldn't Facebook be able to figure it out with $14 billion in free cash flow?
Except that they're a platform, as you point out, right? That's the shield that they use in order to differentiate themselves from, you know, traditional media.
Yeah, I find that irresponsible. Dictionary definition of a media company is a firm that uses a medium for reach and influence. So there is no organization in the world that is more of a media company than Facebook. Facebook defines what it is to be a media company in a digital age. $1 billion in original content, licensing agreements for original content from sports leagues, 50% of Americans get their news from their social feeds now, and then Facebook runs ads, targeted advertising from the world's largest advertisers against that content. They're the most media-ish firm or entity in history. But because media firms trade typically at a lower multiple than tech companies, because our society has come to expect a certain level of discretion or responsibility from the fourth estate, they've decided they're not a media firm. And I don't see this as being any different than if McDonald's was serving 80% fake beef and its patrons were getting encephalitis and making bad decisions. And then the government got angry and said, hey, McDonald's, you're serving 80% fake beef, and it's having very negative ramifications on our society. And as a defense, McDonald's said, hold up. We're not a fast food restaurant. We're a fast food platform. Would we take that for McDonald's? And the answer is no. And so my question is, why do we accept that from Facebook?
Fair point. Well, Scott Galloway, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a great conversation.
Well, I appreciate your time, Peter.
Thanks for listening to the Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please rate us on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please join me next week when my guest will be Fletcher Previn, the Chief Information Officer of IBM. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.